Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
I'll fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome back to another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
Yes, we are back to degrace you with our presence.
And Jeff is on a cell phone, so he may sound a little weird.
And if he's not on a cell phone, well, he sounds weird, then we should just say that we sound weird.
Yes. That's probably true.
Yes, we can blame it on the cell phones, but when you meet us in person and we blame it on the cell phone, it's a little bit weird.
It's disappointing because we're just weird all the time.
Yeah. Or either that or reaffirming to your faith in humanity that we are who we are on the radio, even when we're not on the radio. It's weird. I know. We didn't take on a different persona to do this program. Well, a different persona than you, just my persona. It's not different here.
There's a continuing our discussion from the last hour where we talked about the things that are causing the economy to keep growing. Something that you have to be a bit of a geek to find is a number that I think is very important. And it's inflation adjusted disposable consumer income.
Wow, that's a mouthful. But it's really basically what we all want. We all of us want inflation adjusted consumer disposable income.
The income for consumers in January was reported by the Labor Department. Or no, I'm sorry, from estimates from IHS Market, High Frequency Economics, Goldman Sachs, and JP Morgan. And it comes from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and they're looking at it. So it's coming from a whole bunch of different sources. And believe it or not, with all those subtitles I just put on it, it makes it more reliable. In the first quarter of 2023, the average personal disposable inflation-adjusted income, that's the income a person has after adjusting for inflation over the last year and adjusting for taxes and bills that have to be paid and everything else. It's called excess income. It is an excess. It either goes into savings or gets spent. It rose 4.2%. Now, that sounds like a very small number, a 4.2% rise. But this is important because over the last couple of decades, maybe more, maybe three decades, that number has been shrinking. And it basically is that the cost of things and the things that we have to do and our bills and taxes and everything else have been going up faster than average income. And that has definitely caused a problem. And in 2021 and 2022, we lost ground. And there was a lot of headlines about the fact that the consumer in the United States is losing ground. Actually having less money to spend even after the government gave them stimuli or whatever it was that we've got.
I think it's stimulius. You just combine the two. It's just stimulius.
Well, if it comes from a politician, it's a stimuli, but that's okay.
Exactly.
sorry, politicians.
I'm not. They brought it on themselves.
But a 4.2% gain for January in inflation-adjusted disposable income for consumers is a big thing. This is the kind of thing we see preceding economic booms, not preceding recessions. The other thing is, and we haven't talked about this very much because in fact, it's pretty confusing and complicated. The leading economic indicators that are published by a couple of private agencies in the United States, which have been very predictive of recessions historically, have been down for 11 months now. In other words, for the last 11 months, the leading economic indicators, which function very well in a traditional U.S. economy, have been saying we're headed into a major recession. Here's the problem with that. We have never headed into a major recession ever, ever, ever that wasn't preceded by months and months of falling employment. Falling employment, falling disposable after that number I gave you a moment ago, the after inflation personal disposable income, that falls. Employment falls and everything keeps running along just fine for a while. And certainly the big one in the market and everything else that we had in 2000 through 2002, we saw that falling for almost a year before the market cratered, before the economy slid downhill. All of that was preceded by two major things, a fall in employment and a fall in disposable income. We are seeing rises in employment and rises in disposable income. And we are in a very, very strange economic situation where the traditional predictors, the traditional indicators of what is to come are contradictory.
Yeah. So,
a weird place to be.
Right. So to lay that out, when I quoted last hour, I talked about the leading economic indicators, and we're really fond of this. It's the conference board puts it together. And what is it? What is it that we're talking about here? It's a series of components that they do surveys on. So you've got the leading credit index that talks about delinquencies and things like that. And we've got negatives on that. I was talking about that just a moment ago. The S&P 500, that's a weird one. Why is that a leading indicator? Well, the stock market's generally a leading indicator. Well, right now, as a leading indicator, it's positive again. It's not very positive, but it's up from the bottom. So we have a positive there. You have the interest rate spread on 10-year T-bonds less the federal funds rate. That's a wonky one right now. We've been talking about the inverted yield curve. Well, that's exactly this component. This says, hey, we're inverted. The very short, very, very short overnight rate and the 10-year rate are not good. The spread is negative. We got a bad issue here. So that's a negative here. It peaks up to a positive at some point very shortly. If just the pattern continues that we're seeing, that may be a positive shortly because as we talked about last hour, interest rates are starting to stabilize. We've got consumer expectations for business conditions. We've got the ISM index of new orders. That's manufacturing orders. Those are negative. Consumer expectations are negative. ISM index of new orders are negatives. Building permits for private housing, negative. We know that. Interest rates are up on mortgages. Average weekly hours in manufacturing has been wobbling back and forth month by month, positive, negative, positive, negative. It's at equilibrium. Right now, it's negative. Last time, it was positive, barely. It's barely negative now. Manufacturing new orders, non-defense capital goods. So no aircraft, no big defense type stuff, just normal manufacturing orders. Negative, positive. We're wobbling right at equilibrium there. Manufacturing new orders in consumer goods and materials. That's a positive. Average weekly initial claims unemployment insurance. That's a positive. So the things that we have negative are mildly positive, and the things that we have negative are extremely negative. And yet we're still looking at it and saying there's differences in what we're looking at right now. We have a lot of cash on hand, which the stimulus that was given in 2020 and 2021, the stimuli from the presidents Trump and the president Biden coming through is actually what's keeping us out of a recession right now. Those stimuluses back then kept us out of the recession right now, but we've traded it for inflation. So can we get rid of inflation without a recession? That's the question we've had for over a year now. So far, we're taming slowly inflation. We haven't had a recession yet. So really what we are backseat drivers. And the Fed's at the wheel and saying, we got this, we're going to raise interest rates. They're not trying to prevent a recession. And they've been clear on that. That's not their job. Their job is not to prevent recessions. Their job is to create stability for our currency and to keep employment high. So those are the two jobs of the Fed right now, keep people employed and tame inflation. And they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it. So far, no recession. And obviously, they don't want to make a recession, but that's not in their job. If they make a recession, then they're still doing their job. So from us, the question about whether or not it's a recession comes back to this philosophical one. Because of the employment situation, if we have a recession here, in a weird way, this is going to be a nice recession. It should... Recessions are one of those things that we are great advocates for. We need recessions, and the more of them, the better. You're welcome to gasp at what we just said or be shocked. I just said we want recessions to occur more often than they have been. Why? Because then they're really mild. You don't give them nicknames like the Great One. The Great Recession. No, no thanks. The Pandemic Recession. No, if you go back to the 1940s, all the way up through the 1990s, we averaged a recession every 4 years, and they really weren't that big a deal. They weren't things you wrote home about unless you lost your job in one of them. And most people didn't. They were minor and mild. If we have longer periods between recession, we build up a bunch of dead wood in the forest. And when the wildfire hits, it burns healthy wood with the dead wood if there's too much dead wood. What am I talking about here? You don't know who's not wearing swimming suits until the tide goes out. Recessions are, or bear markets in this case, are how we discover fraud, because you don't look for fraud when everything is good. You look for fraud when things start to break, and this is what you see in the crypto world right now. This is how we discovered mortgage-backed securities weren't as safe as they could be because of recessions. The kinds of things that we clean up in the recession are all the things that were broken. In Turkey right now, they're looking at their construction policies. Why? Is it because they're leaning forward into the future and saying, we will be extra safe because our construction policies will be... No, it's because they just had a big problem. We fix things after they break, unfortunately. It'd be nice if we just built them right the first time. But that's not human nature.
I looked, by the way, at some of the pictures after the earthquake there, and there's something missing. And you don't have to be an engineer to figure this out. If you see a concrete building that has collapsed to dust and rubble,
and there's no metal sticking out of it, like rebar?
And there's no rebar sticking out of the concrete, that is an indication that somebody cut the corners and didn't put the rebar in the building when it was built, and that's why it collapsed and fell to dust.
Right. So this, I was using that as an example because we need events to be bad before we fix things. The old, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's, you know, before the global financial crisis when they're talking about, we shouldn't be giving these loans to people that can't afford to pay for them. And the people respond, well, they haven't been delinquent yet. And my response to that then and now is, I plan on living forever. So far, so good. So far, so good. Only works until it doesn't.
There's a good argument there against pure free enterprise, against which a lot of people would love to see. And that is that the reason that loans were being given to people who couldn't pay them on houses that were phenomenally overpriced before the loan was made is because somebody would buy them from the person who made the loan and pay them well for them. Why would they buy them and pay them well for them? Because they figured out how to package them in such a way that the people buying the packages didn't realize that they were buying a load of garbage and were paying for it, which is where the advantage of having good regulation, particularly at the federal level, and that's about the only way it works in the United States, on such things is so important. And that's the same thing that happened with crypto, or is happening with crypto. I don't know when it'll be over with.
It's getting worse.
No regulation, so the smart people sell garbage to the foolish people and pocket the money and walk away.
And a lot of times, foolish people go broke. Yeah, a lot of times those same smart people have been drinking their own Kool-Aid, and they believe that totally believe that what they're doing is safe for all, and everybody can make money doing it. And that's the issue: is that when you there's incest that occurs when you use the same thing as collateral on lots of different loans. It's not a good thing. It's a bad thing in any way you look at it. We have some concerns right now on the horizon for pretty institutional type companies that aren't falling off the edge of the weirdo spectrum, like newly created crypto exchanges that were worth many, many billions of dollars overnight. That's on the weirdness spectrum. Those are things that you can immediately say, hey, there's a problem. There's some other stuff that we look up. In a rising interest rate environment, we believe we should start to be a little leery and careful around insurance companies, because their portfolios that are driving pensions and annuity payments are based in large part on bond portfolios, and bond portfolios really don't do well in a rising interest rate environment. But they don't have to report those portfolios to anyone. They don't have to say this is what's happened and the value of the portfolio's dropped or that, except if it's a pension company, they may be required to put in a little extra money when interest rates are down. Well, interest rates are up, so they're required to put less money in there. It's a bad situation, and one that we're aware of. The fixed pension is about to go through some scandals. I mean, people have said, hey, and this is the writing on the wall, just as a side note. When Congress starts to say, we need to include in your 401k annuity payments, we need to include in your 401k the concept of a pension, it's because the majority of people believe it's safe. And when the majority of people believe that something that's paying you more than the bank does is safe, that's when the problems tend to occur. Why is that? Well, if it's paying more than the bank, then it's not as safe as the bank, or they wouldn't have to pay you more than the bank. That's just the reality of the world. If you don't have to pay someone more for something, if they say, oh, no, you don't have to pay me more, then why would you? And if an insurance company is going to pay you more than the bank does, they have a guarantee and the bank has a guarantee. So why are they paying more? Because their guarantee is much more limited than the bank's guarantees. And when the majority of people believe that both guarantees are the same, and you see flows of money leaving the really safe lower interest to go to the not as safe higher interests, this is what we've been talking about crypto and about the mortgage-backed security market of 2006, is that when you're packaging something and everyone agrees that it's safe, but it's paying a higher interest rate than a safe thing would, it's not safe. That's just the reality. You can't get by that. I mean, I can show you all kinds of complicated graphs and diagrams about how you can pull apart the credit rating of a mortgage-backed security and see what tranches are being combined in there, but it really comes back to a very common sense concept. It's paying a really high interest rate and claiming to be really safe. Those two things don't go together. That's like a politician that doesn't lie. No, Jimmy Stewart passed away, so Mr. Smith is not in Congress right now. There are no maybes about this. High interest rates don't go with safe things. And in an institutional world where everyone's agreeing that these things are safe because it's just been so long since they failed, but they're starting to do the things that they did way back when before they did fail, that's when we start waving our hands around. That isn't to say get out of all your insurance stuff or any of that. It's do some research and look into what you're doing. Don't stop at the word guarantee. Move beyond it and research what that means. It's important, very important, especially if you have a large amount of your income potential into your golden years wrapped up in this stuff. So just be aware of that. We see that as a threat on the horizon. I know a lot of people are worried about banks right now. I've had a lot of people worried about banks to me. And this is a natural part of any economic cycle. We're really, really concerned and worried about the thing that bit us last time. Even if the thing that bit us last time has a muzzle on and is in the kennel and is going through training, we're still worried about that. That's generally not the thing that's going to bite us this time. The banks have been stress tested consistently, yearly, at their great moaning and complaining by the Federal Reserve again and again, at a higher level of stress than what we saw in the global financial crisis, and they've passed it all. I mean, all of the major banks have passed the stress test. So we're not worried about the banking system. That's the thing that got us last time. You need to look up and say, all right, what are the other bad practices that are echoing what the banks did before they fell apart? Well, crypto just did it. We've been telling you about that for a while, and so have a lot of other people. We can't take credit for being the only voices out there saying crypto's dangerous, but we've been consistent about it. We didn't waffle around at any point and say, no, maybe you could do it. Nope. We said, if you're going to make money in crypto, sell or rent them the computer to mine with. Don't go mining. And we've had people that have done well doing that. They're not making much money today, though, because the mining is down. So all of that is a lot. Those are things that when you're afraid of the bank, check out the Federal Reserve's stress test on said bank. If you're not afraid of an insurance product and you are afraid of a bank, you should be afraid of the insurance product enough to do your due diligence. Anytime you get into any risky situation, being afraid of that risk is important. Rationally afraid of it, if that makes any sense.
What you said is completely correct. To a point. You can check out the insurance company all you want to. And this is one of my soapbox items for years now, but I'm going to stay on it. Historically, when we enter into a period of rising interest rates, life insurance companies, and when I say life insurance companies, that's who issues annuities, have a tendency to fail. Now, which ones are going to fail? Here's the problem.
I can tell you which ones. It'll be the ones that do.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. That's very accurate prediction right there. Write it in your
book. You can go to AM Best or Standard & Poor's or something and see that it's given a very, very high rating. But if you read the fine print on those ratings, it's based on the portfolio they hold at this moment and the demand that's on them at this moment. And let me give you an interesting scenario. Interest rates continue to rise. The bank is offering higher interest rates on CDs. The money market funds are offering higher interest rates. And you bought sometime in the past, let's say a 3.5% or 4% deferred annuity from an insurance company where they promised to pay you 3.5% or 4% as long as you left the money there. And in many cases, there's a 7-year surrender charge on those because they have very, very large commissions and very large surrender charges. But at some point, and by the way, this is what happened in the late 70s and early 80s, people looked around and said, look at there, I can go to a secure place, a government bond, a bank account with FDIC insurance or something, and get a higher interest rate than I'm getting from my insurance company's annuity that I purchased. And it's a single premium deferred annuity, they're called, where they say, I'll give you this much interest. And you take the money out of the insurance company and you put it in the bank. Well, that's a perfectly rational thing to do. And a lot of people did that in the late 70s and as the 1980s began. The problem was because interest rates had been rising during that time period, the portfolios held by the insurance companies, the bonds were worth less than their maturity value. They were worth less than they paid for them. So in order to supply the cash to the people who were liquidating the fixed deferred annuities, they had to sell bonds at a loss. And then they started buying junk bonds. And the regulators in the various states kind of went along with that because junk bonds hadn't failed in a long time and everybody knew that bonds were secure. And they started buying what later were called junk bonds. They're called high yield now and they were called high yield back then. And the regulators kind of went along with it and the rating agencies kind of went along with it and still gave them high ratings. And then we found out that the high yield bond market was in a bubble. Many of you don't remember the name Michael Milliken, but basically he had figured out how to manipulate that market in such a way that he turned gold into junk. And the end result was quite a number of major insurance companies failed. Now, what happens when an insurance company fails and you have an annuity there? Or there's theoretically or maybe or may not be a state guarantee fund that may cover some or all of what you have in there, but in some cases doesn't cover any. Otherwise, you're an unsecured creditor of the insurance company. That's all there is to it. And when I read about today the fact that fixed annuities are now authorized to go into fixed deferred annuities, single premium deferred annuities are now authorized inside 401ks. I am just kind of mind-boggled because the main purpose in using an annuity is to defer taxes. The main purpose in a 401k is to defer taxes. So if you put a tax deferral inside a tax deferral, all you're getting is higher expenses. I don't know that this is going to happen again. I do know that those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And the last time we saw a serious interest rate rise like we're seeing right now was followed a few years later by a lot of insurance companies failing and a lot of people who had money in those insurance companies being very, very unhappy, some of whom I personally witnessed come in to see me after, and all they were getting back is 30 cents on the dollar of what they had invested. So just bear that in mind. There is no such thing as a risk-free situation. And the insurance companies, with their guarantee, the only real guarantee that you have if you get a guarantee from an insurance company is the guarantee of that insurance company, nothing more. There's no FDIC to back them up. There's no federal government to back them up. There's nothing to back them up except the insurance company. And if they fail, you are an unsecured creditor. Just be aware of that. It's reality.
Well said. We're sitting here in a strange time. That's putting it lightly.
That is an understatement.
When parts of what we're experiencing right now are absolutely textbook. I mean, they are more textbook than I've ever experienced in my career. I can look back at history and see it looking like this at lots of times, like the inventory buildup and the bullwhip effect of the supply chains moving up and down. It's very textbook, and these are things that have caused recessions in the past. But we still have some component of that just-in-time delivery stuff happening. What is it about inventory buildup that has caused recessions in the past? This is like the most traditional form of recession is as a manufacturer, you're getting orders, so you're selling to someone and they need to order enough in advance that they have enough on hand to sell their customers. And their customers come in and they say, hey, we want to buy that. And so they order more of it. And they see this is their best-selling item. So they order even more from the manufacturer. They say, we're going to order an extra, extra, extra amount. And they fill up the warehouse with it. Right as whatever was causing that item to be in demand goes away. For whatever reason. It doesn't matter if it's because the Cabbage Patch Kid fad is gone, or the Beanie Babies are just not as popular as they were. If you wind up with a whole bunch of Beanie Babies in your warehouse that aren't being bought anymore, eventually you have to sell them for less than you paid for them. And that's moving backwards. That's what recession means. Your profits not only declined, you may have lost money. You have receded from your top. And when you imagine that across the entire spectrum of everybody buying and selling at the manufacturing level all the way down to the ultimate retail sales location, that was the most normal way of getting into a recession. Inventory buildup followed by we got to sell it for less than we bought it for. We had something that took place late in the 1990s into the early 21st century. The internet popped in. People like Michael Dell stepped forward and said, I'm not going to have a warehouse at all. I'm going to build this computer after somebody tells me what they want. So I'll buy the parts after they give me the money for the whole machine. I don't have to store anything. So that model took off. McLean's right there in Temple, Texas, founded by Drayton McLean, came up with a logistical, and their business model was all based on how do we get products to grocery stores quickly. So they developed a technology that we look at and everybody, it's ubiquitous now, the barcode. You scan the thing and the computer's already ordering what you just bought to be replaced in the store. And the more you do that, the less you need a warehouse. So that model of just-in-time delivery took off. Then we went through the beginning of the 21st century into the global financial crisis with really no big issues recession-wise. We had the dot-com bust because the potential was there for this just-in-time stuff and we overdid it. We got greedy and we had a dot-com bust. And then the global financial crisis hit, which pushed us harder into the just-in-time delivery system. The businesses out there said, we have to do this more. We have to do more with less. And that was a repeated refrain again and again throughout that era. How do we increase our productivity? We can't afford as many employees as we had. So from that point to the pandemic's recession in 2020, we went 12 years without a recession. That's weird. There's no other time in the history of the United States that we've gone that long without a recession, ever. It's just, there's not a time. It was... What happened there? Well, we changed our entire model of how we do business right at the same time period that free trade was really taking off. And then toward the end of this, we started a trade war. Then the pandemic hit. Those two things together have really messed up all that, those decades-long plans of how we don't have to have warehouses. So warehouse space became very limited during the pandemic. Big companies were buying warehouses. Amazon was building them. They're now scrapping the warehouse projects because the supply chain's coming back in a better way with more redundancies and a shorter chain, and you don't have to reach all the way across the globe every time to get everything. So they're now scrapping warehouse projects, which means they're laying people off in construction that were being hired to do warehouses. Well, they still could have built the warehouses, but the interest rates on those things just went up and they didn't want to buy it with cash. So this is the deal, is that money's been spent on things and got scrapped. That's why Amazon's laying people off right now. And you can see it across the tech world. They got ahead of themselves. So this is a normal thing in the cycle. Are we going to have a recession because of it? Probably not because of this, but it could be a component if we do. You have something to add.
Yeah, I want to throw something in here that is kind of it could be construed as political. It's not. And that is, the Congressional Budget Office issued an estimate of the X date. The X date is the time when the United States Treasury will actually run out of money. Now, we're technically using extraordinary measures of the government taking from Peter to pay Paul and whatever. They basically have stopped funding pensions for federal employees so that they can use the money to pay the bills.
And not just stopped funding the pensions, they're also, the G fund in the TSP is kind of a slush fund. They can take the money out of that and use it for a while.
Yeah, and the issue is when, it all depends on how much money comes in with the, when April 15th rolls around, and how much money has been paid on taxes and how much is deferred. So there's a question. It could happen as early as June, could happen as late as August, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Now, here's the problem with this. There are some people in Congress who are quite serious about not raising the debt ceiling without some dramatic changes somewhere in spending. And they've been very vague, other than there has been some mention of cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare. I don't think it's going to happen. There's been some mention of cutting defense. Those are the only three areas that you can cut significantly that'll make a difference in the deficit. So the issue is the threat of not raising the debt ceiling. What happens if they don't raise the debt ceiling? What happens if we go to the wall? And in 2011, we were literally an hour or two away from the United States defaulting. And at one point, as a matter of fact, there was a month or the two-week pay cycle when military personnel did not get a paycheck till late because of that event. Now, here's the problem with that. If indeed we go down to the wire and cross it in this game of let's not raise the debt ceiling to pay for bills that we here in Congress have already voted into existence, we've already said by law, Treasury, you have to spend the money. It may have been different congressmen who did it, but the Congress of the United States said, you got to spend the money, and then saying, no, we're not going to pay the bill. That's what not raising the debt ceiling is. The problem with that is it would instantly cause the interest rate on the federal debt to jump significantly. Let me say that again. It's like if you don't make you decide not to make your credit card payments or your car payments or whatever, what happens to money that you borrow into the future? What happens to the interest rates? It goes up dramatically because you're no longer a good credit risk. If that happens, if indeed the members of Congress, of the House of Representatives, who want to cut spending, push it down to the wire or pass the wire and say, we're not raising the debt ceiling, and the United States stops paying its bills at that point. The last time this happened, Standard & Poor's lowered the United States credit rating from AAA to AA, and interest rates, long-term interest rates, went up dramatically, and it had a significant effect a couple of years on. That could by itself trigger a major recession that would do two things simultaneously: raise long-term interest rates dramatically and cut revenue to the United States government dramatically, and thereby dramatically increase the debt. I don't think a lot of people are thinking about that. It's complex. It is difficult. And I just want to say there's no question in my mind at all. The answer to overspending is not going on strike and not paying your credit card and your house payment and your car payment. The answer to overspending is when the spending bill comes up to have the votes to lower it. And if you don't have a majority to lower the spending, then it isn't going to happen because you're a minority. And using some method that the minority has to keep us from paying the bills as a threat is just, it isn't a matter, I mean, not even, it's not a moral issue, although that's there too. The issue is it will dramatically increase the deficit. It will dramatically increase the money that the United, that has to go to pay debt if they do this. And there are some people in Congress who are determined to do it.
And let me just say, to put this in as clear a possible way as we can, this is not a simple thing to figure out the budget. In 2022, we only have estimates of the receipts for the federal government. This is taxes and tariffs and fees and everything else coming into the federal government. The estimate is $4.436 trillion. So we'll just round that to 4.4 for reasonable purposes. Well, what did we spend in 2022? Well, we have different places of looking at that and different ways of measuring it. How is that? Well, if we look at what we spent, so remember the 4.4 number. Medicare cost us $1.5 trillion last year. Social Security cost us $1.3. National Defense cost us $1.2. Health, that includes Medicare, and was $1.1. And Income Security, those are pensions and so on for the government employees, but also shoring up pension funds for private companies. So if you add all that together, you're up at the $5.2 trillion. And that's just Social Security, Medicare, National Defense, health, and income. This isn't the stuff. This isn't foreign benefits. This isn't the highway department. This isn't interest on the debt. Interest on the debt, as a side note, was $736 billion last year. If you start adding that all up, you realize that we're spending just on the things that nobody wants to cut. We're spending more than we make. Do we still want to have a national defense? Because if we don't pay our bills by not raising the debt ceiling, then we're not going to pay Boeing for the new jets, and we're not going to pay BAE for the new Bradleys, and we're not going to buy any more helicopters because they're not going to give it to us for free. So just the stuff that even the Republicans do not want to cut are more than the tax revenue. Either raise the taxes or we have to keep borrowing, or we have to cut the things that nobody wants to cut. This is not simple. You don't hear me making suggestions here, because you can step on toes really easy. Talk about cutting Medicare and somebody's going to come at me with a knife. Social Security, yeah, I might get drive-by shootings. National Defense, it may be rockets. So all of those are important things. We don't want people that are elderly in the United States to starve. We don't want their medical bills to be so great that they can't pay them. Medicare and Social Security is paying out far more than they ever collected. But this was an obligation we put on ourselves. We got to pay for it, or we have to cut it. Do you want to be the one that tells grandma she can't go get her surgery? That's where we are right now. And there's hard, hard decisions that have to be made at a time when the polarization about stupid things is taking up 100% of our time. It isn't talking about how do we fix Social Security? How do we fix Medicare? Nope. Not on the table for discussion at the moment. We're just going to talk about whether or not we should pay the debt. That's silly. And it sounds political because right now it's the Republicans that are making the fuss. But if you'll recall, we make the same commentary when it's the Democrats that are choosing. I mean, it's not like the Democrats are being smart about it now either. Just the Republicans are being loudest about it. And I realize because it's a team sport, politics, that people get offended if you talk bad about the team. But the reality is that we're looking at the sport in general, not the way the game is played. The game is played as being messy right now. The sport needs work. The rules of the sport need work. We need to figure out how to pay debts. We need to figure out how to not go into free fall because people don't want to pay for things that we've already spent.
You know, what can't be undone, and I wouldn't undo it if I could, are the stimulus packages, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were two passed by the Republicans and one passed by the Democrats. And
that's debt we have to pay. We said it at the time.
Right. And the issue is you can't undo that. You can't claw that money back. Well, I guess you could. You could.
That's what taxes are. You would raise taxes to do that.
You could go, Congress could pass a law that says, yes, whatever you received as a stimulus check, you have to pay it back. I don't think that would go over real well. Yeah.
We want you to forgive our forgiven loan to you by forgiving it back to us, by giving it just to us. Thank you.
Right. And I've never heard anybody say they want to do that. But the bottom line to it is, yes, we've run up a huge debt. There's two ways to solve that. We either cut one of the things or several of the things that Jake just mentioned, or we raise taxes. The biggest single, and this is just my conclusion after looking at it, we had a major tax cut just before the pandemic hit. Maybe a lot of you don't remember it. The Tax Reduction Act.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We had a major tax reduction just before we spent a tremendous amount of money. And now we have a big debt. Well, excuse me, but duh. Go back to, I won't even say who did it. Go back to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act
equivalent.
Look to you. You do your research. Who was it that cut the revenue? And the theory, the stated objective was to raise revenue by cutting taxes. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office and everybody else who's looked at it said we managed to reduce revenue by cutting taxes, which makes tremendous common sense.
And this is something we talked about at the time. When you raise taxes and revenue goes up, and then you lower taxes, you shouldn't expect revenue to go up again.
I am hearing, reading messages from members of Congress, or one member, or my member of Congress, who dramatically supported the Tax Cuts Act, the Tax Cut and Job, Tax Reduction and Jobs Act. No,
Tax Cuts and Jobs
Act. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Yeah.
Now being vocal in support of the fact that we should, and also, by the way, supported the stimulus bills that the Republicans passed at the time. He's a Republican. Now saying he doesn't think we should raise the debt ceiling and thereby pay the debts that we've incurred. He's not going to like it if he hears that I said this, but he doesn't like me particularly much now anyway. He used to be on our show, but folks, that's irresponsible.
Yeah, we got to pay our debts. This is something we believe to be fundamentally important to any economy, is the value of your word. That is what a bond means. It means a promise. If we don't pay our promises, we are liars, and we are letting the politicians determine that for us. Yikes! We got to play some commercials before it's too late, or they're going to cut us off and play them anyway. So we'll be right back with after these quick messages with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We only have about 3 minutes left. So do you want to do a wrap up for the day? We haven't done a wrap up in a while.
Well, we've had a market that's basically moving sideways in a very bumpy fashion. We have an economy that is going in some direction. We don't know what, because we're seeing very, very conflicting signals as to whether we're going to have a recession, a soft landing, or quite possibly a boom ahead. And we're getting signals that all of the three, it'd be interesting if we had all three at the same time. I don't think we've ever had that, but it would be consistent with the craziness we've seen over the last several months. And that's kind of the bottom line to it, is the economy is growing along very nicely. All the indicators are it shouldn't be, but it is anyway. And interest rates are going higher. and likely to stay higher.
Yeah. So we're in an odd time where business is still growing. People are still getting raises. At the same time, that structurally people are looking, the people that look at the economy are going, whoa, we've got worrisome stuff on the horizon. And we also have the potential of growing out of this without a recession. So when I'm talking to small business owners, they're doing a lot better this year than they were even a year ago. When I talk to people that are executives at tech companies, not so much. So this is just like what we've been talking about for several years. The economy is not even. There are some people doing better and some people doing worse. During the pandemic, this was very true. It's just a different groups of people now. So there's imbalances and weird disequilibriums. There's a good economics term for you for the day. Any way you look at it, though, we're out of time. Thank you very much for listening to our mumblings and ramblings about silly things that on the surface are truly silly, but long-term kind of are the hinges for our entire economy to turn on. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized investment advice and portfolio management to people of high net worth. The numbers to call locally with voicemail during the weekend, but real live people and no phone tree during the week is
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that same line toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Should you still have a landline? You can go to our webpage, The Personal Wealth Coach, or tpwc.com, where you can see our Made for Radio faces, explore our wonderful staff. You can read our newsletters, which come out every Friday. Sign up for the newsletter, or you can listen to our radio program. You can listen to podcasts. You can find podcasts wherever they're found. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
We did it.